So welcome to the Secure in Mind podcast. Today's guest is someone who I find quite inspirational. I'm really looking forward to jumping into this conversation. Often I don't do this with guests. I don't read out the background or the blurb that highlights some of their achievements, but I think it's especially deserved in this case because my guest, Drew Sullivan, has been quite instrumental in uncovering some of the depths and depravity of corruption at the highest level across the globe for many years. So let me read this out to you. Drew Sullivan is a serial entrepreneur who founded and edited the Center for Investigative Reporting in Bosnia-Herzegovina in 2004. He co-founded the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Program, where he serves as editor. He founded the Journalism Development Network, an innovative media development organization with programs worldwide. As a journalist, he led a team of reporters looking at corruption by the Bosnian Prime Minister, which led to his eventual indictment and resignation. Under his direction, OCCRP has won the Daniel Pearl Award 2 times, the Online Journalism Award 2 times, the Global Shining Light Award 3 times, the Tom Renner Award for Crime Reporting 2 times, the European Press Prize, and dozens of others. He was an investigative reporter for the Tennessean and the Associated Press. He has served or is serving on the boards of Investigative Reporters and Editors, the National Institute for Computer Assisted Reporting, CIN and Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism. And this is my favorite part. Before becoming a journalist, he was a professional stand-up comedian and an aerospace engineer on the Space Shuttle Project for Rockwell Space Systems. So, Drew, welcome. And before we get into the good stuff, so you were a comedian.
Some people thought so.
Well,
not everybody.
As long as you know that the rehearsals in front of the mirror go well, then half the audience is satisfied. So, wow, that's it's an impressive background. Where to begin? I think first of all with this podcast, there is a very broad, large and broad audience. Some of that audience constitutes students who are looking to develop or understand what their direction might be in terms of degree or life path. And it's got an overarching security theme. And I think investigative journalism and what you do is very much sitting there as a it's an inspirational topic to explore, as is the avenue to get to the position. So why don't we wind the clock back and tap into your background and understand how you went from stand-up comedian to, you know, a multiple prize award-winning investigative journalist investigating corruption up to the highest levels of government.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of an odd story, and it's a little bit of luck and a little bit of being in the right place at the right time. But, you know, I started actually when I was an aerospace engineer, and I found that I worked for Rockwell Space Systems on the Space Shuttle project, and we ended up having, you know, a lot of work to do and then not much work to do for periods of time. And so I took classes at UCLA at night, to kind of broaden out my interests, and I just took an investigative reporting class on the LARC, and you know, the teacher of that class was quite inspirational to me, and I kind of got a bug for solving, you know, problems. Engineering is a type of problem solving, and investigative reporting is a type of problem solving, and I just kind of got really interested in the details of how you know, investigate and put things together. And I went and got a master's degree. The stand-up comedy came actually later as I got more interested in writing, because comedy is really difficult to write. And it's really kind of wordcraft. And so I got fascinated by comedy and how that works and how you be funny. I can't say I always succeeded on it, but... You know,
I made
exactly. I made enough money to go broke in the stand-up comedy business, so I did it for about a year. But it was a fascinating experience, and I had a really good time doing it. But, you know, the
I imagine it's a big jump as well if someone's just generally funny in the crowd of their friends versus writing material that's that hits the funny nerve with the audience. Is probably miles apart.
Exactly. You could be funny and not be funny.
Yeah.
Which I experienced at times, but it also is there's a lot more to it. It's like playing poker, you know.
Yeah.
Poker is not just about knowing the numbers. It's about knowing the people, and it's about it's about personality, and it's about eliminating fear and other things. So it's complex, and I love kind of complex problems. And investigative reporting is really the same because it is a technical skill of uncovering a complex money laundering operation, but it's also a personal skill of understanding who would do this type of thing and getting them to talk to you.
Yeah.
So it's got this wonderful, kind of multifaceted complexity that makes it kind of a really cool problem.
Okay, so that covers a bit of the background. Now let's fast forward to setting up the where should we begin? Setting up the Center for Investigative Reporting in Bosnia Herzegovina, or the OCCRP. Maybe you want to do a quick walkthrough of the CIN, and then we can move on to the OCCRP.
Sure. I mean, I came over to Bosnia. It's kind of a little bit of a break in my journalism career. I came over to do some training and kind of give back to people, and I really didn't have any idea what I was getting into.
Mm-hmm.
Going to Bosnia, where in America, stories are about quality of life, and in Bosnia, they were really still about life and death.
Yeah,
and so I found that really, stories that my last project at the Tennessean was a 12-part piece on water sewers. not the kind of thing that it was. It was important, but it wasn't the kind of stories I envisioned doing.
Yeah.
When I got to Bosnia, there was really fascinating stories going on. So I kept coming over to do trainings and other things, and finally I was asked to come and spend 4 months there to do some intense training, and I had to quit my job to do that because they didn't want me to go over.
Mm.
So I left the Tennessean and I spent 4 months there, and that led to another year and a half of work or so with a nonprofit organization. And then the people I was working with at the U.S. government said, "We're going to close this all down. It's not doing much good." And I said, "Well, you have to leverage standards into industries. You got to show how it's done. You can't just teach. You have to kind of sometimes just do."
Mm.
And so they said there was a opportunity coming up for proposals, and I put one in to build an investigative center.
And how does that get funded? Was that through, say, United States Department funding, or USAID, or was it a mixture? Or
yeah, that early project was fully funded by USAID, and
yeah.
So it was basically media development. How do we get journalists in this country to really do great work? And the reality is there's great journalists everywhere. You just need to give them the resources, the time, and direction. An expectation of what they should achieve, and some training on the skills, and they can do it. And so, and then OCCRP really came out of, taking the Center for Investigative Reporting and then regionalizing, the work. I ran into a very interesting character named Paul Radu in a training I was doing. And, Paul was really, the first pure investigative reporter I had met in the Balkans.
Yeah.
He'd been doing it well before other people. He was doing it to an international standard. And as we talked, we realized we were working on literally the same stories with the same people. And, the light went on, and it seems, naive now to look back, and, I seemed quite naive. But, what I realized is, crime and corruption is really a regional issue.
Yeah,
and it's the same groups working throughout regions, and law enforcement only goes up to borders.
Yeah,
Interpol is just a communications device; it's not a law enforcement body.
Yeah.
There is no law enforcement body on regional levels, and organized crime has no no natural enemy.
Yeah,
it's got no, you know, predator that you know, and it just grows and blossoms, and investigative reporters are really the ones who can do the same thing. They can cross borders and they can communicate with each other, and they can do stories across borders. And so we said, let's do stories across borders on these same people. And our first one that we did together won a Global Shining Light Award, actually the first ever Global Shining Light Award. And we said, wow, this works. Let's do more of this. And so, you know, that was 2007. And we just found like-minded journalists. The one thing about the Balkans and then eventually Russia and the CIS states is nobody wants a good investigative reporter. You know, they're just a pain in the butt. You know, they get the newspaper in trouble. They get the owner in trouble. And so I just collected as many great investigative reporters as I could find and put them together, got them the resources, and then they did the amazing work.
Yeah. It's just, reminding me of something that you said previously about the types of stories in about sewerage in the United States and then the contrast between life and death kind of scenarios over there. You know, my background, I'd spent a fair bit of time working in alongside development sector in Guatemala, with the murder rate at the time was 17 murders per day, impunity 99%. So the life I admired the courage and the craziness of the investigative journalists in Guatemala and Mexico, where the murder rates were just astonishing. So it's it's an incredibly gutsy but necessary profession. So let's have a look at one big question. How do you start an investigation? So you mentioned that Paul and yourself had a meeting of the minds. You're working on a similar kind of thing. Does it vary? Does it depend on, say, a tip that you get from an anonymous source that then you pull the thread and then you realize the thread is very long and then you expand on that? How does it work in general?
Yeah. I mean, it really... It's a good question, and one I don't ever think about anymore because the stories just pile up now. And but you know, there's really...
there's never a shortage of corruption.
Yeah, no, it's a growth industry, so you know, we're going to be busy for a long time. You know, the interesting thing is that stories usually either start bottom up or top down.
Yeah.
So the bottom up stories are just, you know, a reporter in the field has seen something interesting. They know something about somebody, they hear something and they say, wow, I think there's a conflict of interest here. Or I think that, you know, this gigantic new development is owned by an organized crime figure. And then they'll come to us and say, hey, I want to do the story and I want to work with you on it.
Yep.
But then it also could be, you know, we worked on Panama Papers. And so, you know, ICIJ came to us and Süddeutsche Zeitung and said, hey, you know, will you help us go through these records of people in your part of the world and help us figure out what they're doing here?
Yeah.
You know, and so a lot of our projects come from, you know, big leaks of data and, you know, and that's happening more and more. I've got 7 or 8 leaks I haven't even gotten to yet.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely, we've gone way past the days of the 12-part sewer project. You know, I mean, there's, you know, if it's not worth a couple $100 million, we just don't have time to do it. You know, I mean, that's how ridiculous some of these cases are. And so, you know, but also, you know, stories ooze, you know, they start off as one story and then they connect to other stories. And, you know, we've seen this, especially with our laundromat projects. You know, we coined the term laundromat for these kind of all-purpose criminals, financial structures that have been set up in Russia and various countries, Latvia and places. And, you know, it's kind of a lot. It's kind of the basis of how the developing world, you know, global economy of the developing world works, where you have these kind of financial fraud vehicles that are used to move money around and either, you know, embezzle or, you know, hide from taxes or launder money. And, you know, as we kind of connected to one of them, you know, it connected to a bunch of our previous stories, like the Magnitsky story about the Russian lawyer who exposed the largest tax fraud in Russian history and then ended up getting jailed for it and eventually died in prison. You know, we looked at that story, and then we found that many of these transactions went through some of the laundromats.
Yeah.
And that led to different stories. And then these laundromats, you know, led to bribery of European officials and other things. And that's the way not only organized crime moves money around, but legitimate businessmen, you know, who are avoiding, you know, taxes, do it. And it's also the governments of Russia and Azerbaijan and these countries move money to the West, you know, to, you know, to pay for political parties and, you know, bribe officials and do the other stuff they're doing. So, you know, everything gets, you know, eventually you start, you know, pulling the string, and, you know, you're pulling a string on 20 carpets, you know, and
yeah.
you realize everything is connected, you know, and,
and when you're talking about scale of, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, you're not really touching. It's bigger than that. You are talking about a government level, people in government, having that kind of not that kind of pull, but that kind of oversight of massive money movement. And how do you contend with that? How do you bring them to justice in their own country? Well, I guess that's a pretty difficult concept. It's more about putting embargoes or restrictions from them from the international perspective. Is that kind of the only tools available? Or
I mean, a lot of times we've had significant impact even in places like Russia. People have been arrested, but you know, a lot of the corruption is, you know, you have to understand how some of these countries work. I mean, Russia, you know, uses its organized crime people to get stuff done, to murder people that you know, Putin wants murdered, get money to people they want money to be gotten to, and other things like that. So, you know, Russia has a criminal policy,
yeah.
so to speak, and they don't work by a Western standard, so they don't, you know, what's going on there is completely violating most of the laws of Russia, but it's a, you know, it's an oligopoly. It's a small number of people who control everything, and by controlling the money, you control who has power and interest, which is why people like Khodorkovsky and others have been crushed, because they had money, but they weren't in the same game.
Yeah.
They weren't playing along with the Russian government. So, and many developing world countries have this kind of new autocratic government that's doing this. And so, and it's tied in with their business, because Putin only gives big contracts to people he trusts.
Yeah.
And they, of course, kick back money to him. So, you know, it's kind of a you know, this it's a kind of an internal, you know, wrapped up in itself type of system. So, you know, so the corruption that's going on there is just, you know, there is no rule of law. Rule of law is political.
Mm.
And you see that in, you know, in the United States, where you see, you know, they're turning, you know, rule of law into a political animal.
Yeah.
And that's one of the steps towards autocracy, where there is no, you know, common basis where you can judge things. There's no rules that you can say this can be done and this cannot be done.
Yeah.
It all becomes corruption. And that's why if I go to Russia or one of these places and I look at any contract or any tender or any big deal, I will always find corruption, because the system itself is corruption.
Are you allowed or able to travel to Russia without too many worries, or any of the other countries that you've had a major impact? I mean, take for example Bosnia, where it led to the one of the investigations that you were a part of led to the arrest or the indictment and resignation of the Bosnian Prime Minister. Do you find it restrictive? What's the security and precautions that you need to take personally, and also that your staff need to take?
Yeah, it's you know, obviously, when you're telling the truth in a country that doesn't really want the truth told, it becomes problematic. So, yes, it's very problematic. The last two editors we sent to Russia were arrested and deported. So, no, I can't travel to Azerbaijan or Russia or, you know, probably Kazakhstan anymore.
Mm.
And it's difficult for many of our reporters to do that. No, but we try to work with reporters in country. That can be problematic. In Azerbaijan, we have two reporters who've been arrested. One is still in prison. Family members have been arrested of reporters who leave the country. So it's a we're the nail sticks that sticks up, and we get pounded quite heavily. And so security is obviously an issue. We've had one reporter who's been murdered, you know, who was working with us, you know. It's and I've lost other colleagues who I knew, you know, who were murdered. So it's increasingly getting increasingly difficult to do this work, and so we have to come up with new ways and new systems for doing it. But the truth has to get out, and you know, the local reporters are committed to doing this in many, many countries. They refuse to give up, and so we just have to find creative ways to make their job safer. And we've developed fairly sophisticated ways to do that,
including technological methods as well. I imagine you work quite close with BFF and other technological consulting agencies that you get assistance as well in order to protect sources and reporters as best possible.
And we're regularly hit by, you know, places like the GRU, the Russian military intelligence groups, and others that you know, have been regularly spear phishing us and doing all these types of things. So, you know, a lot of information comes into journalists. It's kind of a nice junction point of information. And so they're of interest in many, many countries. Even friendly ones are, you know, will monitor journalists. So it's just, you know, the nature of the business is it's very complex. You have lawsuits, you have, you know, threats, you have, you know, attacks, you have, you know, snooping. We have some of our reporters are constantly surveilled by state intelligence agents, you know, and they still manage to churn out stories. I mean, they are really the heroes of the story.
Okay, well, let's focus on one or two major investigations and see how they began and where they ended up. Maybe a good place to start is the one that I mentioned, in which I believe you won an award for, which was the investigation of the Bosnian Prime Minister. How did that begin? And just give us a bit of a walkthrough as to, you know, the steps that you needed to take in order to get the story, get the, I imagine also get the public interest for the story as well, to keep that drip feed going. And then what happened?
Yeah, that was kind of a funny story, because it actually started off as a story about railroads. We had promised a donor.
And then you railroaded him.
Not quite, but he had been the former head of the railroads.
Okay.
And so we had started looking at you know, the railroads, and we were looking at rolling stock and, you know, what had disappeared during the war, and, you know, where the assets of the railroad company was disappearing to, and, you know, who might have ended up with the assets. So we started looking at some of the leaders of the railroad and what assets that they had. And, you know, it's interesting. You can tell really big stories of massive corruption, but they don't always resonate with people. But we found in that particular story kind of a cool aspect. We had found that he had gotten a free house, a free apartment in a nice part of town. And he had done it in a very interesting way. He had basically, he went around and he picked out his apartment. And then he, the government bought that apartment saying it needed an apartment. And then it said, well, we don't need the apartment, so we're going to put it in our excess apartment list. And then he privatized it using this privatization script that was around at the time. And so he bought it for about $900 in script, and it was probably about a, you know, €150,000 apartment, you know, which is expensive in Sarajevo. But the interesting thing about this is he did this all in 1 week. Wow. Now you can't do anything in 1 week in Bosnian bureaucracy. So actually what was interesting about the story is, you know, we had to go into Bosnian law and Bosnian tender processes and figure out exactly, you know, what steps had been done. And in fact, the state had put the house on an excess list even before it technically owned the house. You know, so it was very clear that it was violating. And this is not a big corruption issue. But what happened is that story resonated with the people in Bosnia many who had still could not privatize their family home and had been working for decades to get the house that they had lived in, you know. And so here's this prime minister coming out and getting this. And it resonated with one of the local groups who started putting out, you know, billboards around town saying, you know, apartments for $900, you know, call the prime minister. And the prime minister then went and started calling these, you know, billboards illegal, because almost everything in Bosnia is built illegally. So he started tearing down. Every time this would go up on a billboard, he would tear it down, you know, and this kind of heavy-handed things just didn't go well with the public. And so an ambitious, you know, prosecutor indicted him on this, and his political party lost trust in him. He was never convicted because all the records had disappeared. And in fact, when we called asking for the business records, you know, the real estate records, it was the prime minister who called us back and said, you know, why do you want these? And in fact, they all disappeared. We were able, you know, to use the wonderful Bosnian bureaucracy to find that you also have to, you know, put all the stuff in with the water department and the electricity department, proving that you own the apartment. So he had filed with those, and we were able to get them in another source. But the original court documents, the Bosnian politicians passed a law saying you must have the original document in order to prosecute. And of course, all the original documents had disappeared. Yeah. So we eventually were not able to prosecute him, and he's still a business leader in Bosnia, but we were able to sour his political party on him and sour his future political ambitions.
Mm. And a lot of this is from an investigative journalist perspective, is knocking on doors. And how do you find that as a how do you find the success in, say, for example, approaching a department within the bureaucracy of Bosnia and asking for those records? Do you have difficulty? Do you approach as investigative journalist X? How does that work? This is coming from someone who doesn't understand this world as much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's this is what we call follow the money journalism. So it really is documents based. So we're really, you know, we need to find those documents, and we need to show how things were done. Mm. And, you know, the reality is in that particular case, you know, we went to one of the utility companies, and somebody knew somebody who worked somewhere where in Bosnia, everybody knows somebody. Mm. And we were able to get those records. And, you know, the thing about it is, in these autocratic corrupt systems, you know, the workers, you know, who run government know what's going on often, and they're not particularly sympathetic, you know, to some of these people in high positions. Mm. You know, they see what's going on, and they're willing to, you know, give records up. So, mm. you know, you can have a master class that controls, you know, all the other people, but it doesn't mean all the other people are happy about it. No. And so that's why I think we're in the age of leaks, and more people saying, you know, hey, we may not be able to get him kicked out, but we can certainly let people know what's really going on here. And, you know, people appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so important as well, because then, you know, I've spoken about this a number of times on the podcast, but it's very difficult to convey in a 2-minute soundbite on a major media outlet that when Kazakhstan does something, that doesn't speak for every single Kazakhstani person. Far from it. It speaks from a governmental position led by an autocrat.
Absolutely.
And there's a vast difference between that and the population. So,
it's that way in America.
yeah, exactly. So does the head of state answer for, and does he answer for all Americans? Well, of course not. So,
and that's really the problem. Is I think, you know, we're seeing for the last 30 or so years the rise of plutocracy, and you've seen it in the UK, and you've seen it in Western countries, where increasingly money is represented and people are not. And these systems are designed, you know, to disempower the public. You know, things like, you know, in the United States, you know, super PACs, you know, you can give as much money from one person to a political, you know, party or candidate as you want to,
yeah.
as long as you don't coordinate, you know. Well, come on, everybody coordinates. Yeah. And in Russia, that would be seen as bribery. You know, in the United States, it's, you know, freedom of speech. You know, so it's all really, it is the legalization of corruption. And that is disempowering huge parts of the population. And that's why you were seeing, you know, historic records for, disparity in income and resources, you know, that are happening. I mean, that's a conscious effort by groups of people whose interest is, you know, to take over as much of the power and the money as possible. And this is led by, you know, what we call the criminal services industry, which are the law firms and the business registration firms and the lobbyists and others who often work directly for criminals and who really helped globalize organized crime and corruption. So about 30 years, you know, when the offshore industry started, that really helped globalize corruption. And that led to, you know, this very wealthy criminal services industry, which has helped globalize this whole process of, you know, growing plutocracy. And if you look around the world, you know, President Anastasiades in Cyprus is a former global, you know, is a former criminal services guy. You know, many of the top leaders of Cyprus are, you know, Donald Trump, you know, built apartments for organized crime figures, you know, sold them to them. I mean, he's part of criminal service. Paul Manafort is criminal service. Roger Stone is criminal service. I mean, if you go around, many of the people with political power now and money are really from this industry, which has helped globalize crime and corruption and has helped, you know, really implant this plutocratic form of government over the last 30 years, which has made, you know, the public poorer and less, less powerful and less wealthy.
What do you think the seeds were? You mentioned the offshore industry. Do you see that as where maybe a partial catalyst for the ability to shift large amounts of money out of proper jurisdiction and oversight, and then back into run by criminals and back into the hands of people in power?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's really what globalized, you know, this corruption. It's this offshore industry. You know, it's this industry that, you know, has really helped make this possible. So, you know, it's a good idea in corruption, you know, globalizes very quickly. It goes all over the place.
Yeah. Does OCCRP do investigations in the United States? Is it global or is it predominantly in your region?
Yeah, we're predominantly in kind of that, you know, from the edge of Europe over to the Chinese border, but we do work with, you know, kind of partners worldwide. So we, what we do is we implant editors, you know, at other kind of global or regional networks of investigative reporting organizations. So we work with Arab Reporters for Investigative Journalism. We work with CLIP in Latin America, which does work. So we try to find networks we can team up with so that we can truly globalize, because the whole secret is to have local journalists who know the local people and who understand the local issues.
And I imagine you also, in order to generate interest and potential action on major stories, do you work with more major media outlets, say, you know, the BBCs or the Guardians of the World or those types of organizations? Or
absolutely. I mean, we reach more people than the New York Times, because we're not one organization. We're first of all, we're about 25 investigative reporting nonprofit organizations. We're a lot of local media, and what we do is we partner with the Guardian, Süddeutsche Zeitung, the BBC, BuzzFeed, a number of different organizations, and then we try to get our stories everywhere. So that's kind of the model that we've been using, and it's been working quite effectively.
Yeah. Do you also work with Elliot from Bellingcat?
We have, yeah. I mean, Bellingcat is more an activist organization, than it is really an investigative reporting organization, but they essentially do investigative reporting. And so, we've worked on a number of projects together. We've brought in their expertise when we've needed it, and, they're great people.
Yeah, well, Elliot was a former guest on the podcast as well, so this will be right at home in one of the promotions that I send about it. What's the blowback from outing criminal networks across all levels of society, all stratas of the criminal network, up to the political? You mentioned before that there are restrictions on travel, but also much more grave that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation. You've known people, industry peers, and even one reporter working for you who was murdered. Do you see additional protections or more awareness and protections from police? Do you see that as constantly jeopardized because they are endemic and a part of a systemic issue? How do you see that improving, not improving?
Yeah, I mean, justice and law enforcement is often political in many of these countries too, and so we are outside of the accepted political stream. So consequently, law enforcement is often a problem for us rather than a source of protection. And so, this is how it's done. One of the first things that's is to disable the media.
Yep.
And, the large media is easy to do that too, because, they're reliant on advertising dollars, and advertising is of course political. And especially the television industry is easily captured, and that reaches a certain part of the population that's not likely to read complex investigative stories. So you essentially capture the television industry, you capture the population in a country. And so
Berlusconi.
Exactly. Yeah. And our mission is, and that's the purpose of Fox, that's the purpose of RT, that's the purpose of Sputnik, and these are basically propaganda channels supporting a particular political interest. And so our mission is to disrupt that as much as possible. They've got billions of dollars, we've got millions of dollars, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars. So it's not a fair fight. But what happens is that people want to know what's going on in the world.
Yeah.
And so even though we're small, people find us.
Yeah.
And even though we don't have the reach, sometimes people find us. And so we get huge traffic for our stories, but we also have to do a better job of reaching a wider possible audience. I mean, our stories are still too complex, and we're looking at ways to reinvent investigative reporting so that people can get it in other ways, and they don't need to necessarily read that big story, but they can find the information that they need to really make decisions in their lives.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because a lot of the wonderful investigation does span 20 pages, and frankly, most people don't have the time, and some people don't really have the maybe the ability to understand the complexities within that case. So that's an area that you're actively working on. What are some ideas in order to condense that or make it into, dare I say it, sound bites, because that sometimes really takes away from the nuance that's necessary and the reason as to why it's such a long page. But
yeah, I mean, you have to work if you want to know what's going on.
Yeah.
You have to do some basic work. So, but there's things like, we're looking at, so we do a lot with technology. And we've built the world's largest kind of database of criminality and organized crime, and we have over 1 billion entities in that.
Yeah.
And so what we increasingly want to do is do things like do overlays, so that people, when they're going through their websites, can find out if there's an organized crime connection. So
yeah.
You go to TripAdvisor and you book a hotel in Montenegro. And then our overlay will tell you, oh, by the way, do you know that hotel is owned by organized crime? You want to read about them? Here's information. And so
it's setting up partnerships with the TripAdvisors or the Airbnbs or whatever of the world. Okay.
Well, they won't make that partnership. they don't want you to know how many. Yeah, they want you to know how many hotels are really owned by organized crime. But you can do an overlay that when that information shows on your screen, that it can alert you that this name is in your database and you might want to get some information on them.
Yeah.
So You know, I mean, I think, you know, that's the problem is, you know, you know,
the problem, if it's too effective, is there's nowhere to stay.
Exactly. Well, you know, you can stay at places that you want, but, you know, at least you should know what the story is. So
yeah.
I'm sure I've stayed at organized crime hotels. But, you know, the thing is, you want to empower the legitimate business people. And if they just get, you know, if you switch 2 or 3 or 4% of the traffic over, that's sometimes the barrier from, you know, being successful to not. So,
yeah.
You know, most businesses operate between 2 and 10% in terms of, you know, that's a doable number, you know,
it's fickle. And if there's a 2 or 4% shift, that could be in the, you know, a business or bust. So.
Right. And the more, you know, legitimate businessmen who go out of business, and that's a real problem of organized crime. They really, you know, they're parasitic and they destroy legitimate businesses and they try to use monopolies to make their money by not particularly innovating or offering a good product.
Yeah.
You know, so in organized crime places, you know, you find there's very little choice and the choice sucks most of the time. And, you know, you get that drab Soviet, you know, feel,
yeah.
You know, because you can't do anything about it, you know. So, you know, that's, I think, you know, where you can make a big difference is you can empower, you know, legitimate business people at the expense of organized crime.
Mm.
You know, you shouldn't have to stay at Trump's hotel and, you know, next to the White House.
Yeah.
You know, you should be able to stay in some place that, you know, is good, you know, and the prices are reasonable and it's not a political connection that you may not want to, you know, be making. So,
yeah. Okay. I guess we're sort of reaching the end of it, but I've really enjoyed the chat. What are you working on now? Obviously you can't go into depth, but what can we be looking forward to expecting? How can I help and how can anyone help to further the reach of OCCRP and the messages that you guys are trying to show to the world?
Well, we got, there's a lot of stuff going on. We got about 90 different projects that are ongoing.
Wow.
We've identified 5 or 6 other laundromats that as we get around to them, we will, you know, make those available to people. You know, we're looking at, you know, how various countries, we're looking at country level stuff a lot now, how, you know, countries help other countries avoid sanctions and you know, do things, you know, that are basically, you know, prevent kind of the international community from sanctioning anybody.
Yep.
You know, so, I mean, those are all issues that we're interested. We're obviously interested in the criminal services industry and the London law firms who help organize crime, attack journalists, you know, those types of things are of great interest to us. We'll be of course, focusing on, you know, the banks and the law firms and the others who are, you know, empowering criminals. But, you know, I mean, I think, you know, in the long run, helping OCCRP is difficult because of us. You know, we haven't figured out how to have people help us yet. To be brutally honest, I don't have enough resources and enough people to really help manage that relationship. And so we understand this is a weakness that we have. You know, we're always, you know, welcome, you know, people, ideas to help us make that more possible. You know, but I have limited resources and limited staff time. You know, everybody we have is, when we hire somebody, they already have about 150% of the work a person needs for the year.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we're always hiring people way beyond, you know, after we needed to hire them because of, you know, resources. So, you know, what we hope is that people read our material, people, you know, retweet and send that information around to as many people. You know, and we, you know, I always personally listen to all emails that are sent in, you know, so where I can, we try to connect them. You know, we've got a lot of tips and we've got a lot of information coming in, and we try to address as much as possible. But, you know, this is unfortunately, you know, we're way, way, way overtasked and, you know,
way underfunded.
Way underfunded. I mean, we've got more funding and we do more investigative content than any organization on earth. We do over 100 investigative stories a year.
Wow.
And so we are a giant producer of investigative. So I can't complain. We have more money than most nonprofit investigative reporting organizations. But the reality is that, you know, we're at the level of, we have about $10 million a year now that we spend on investigative reporting. And in just, you know, Hungary alone, the Orban government has spent over $1 billion in media control.
Yeah. And you've got to compete with that. Yeah.
And we're competing with that. And Russia has spent billions more in propaganda and other things. So misinformation, I mean, we're talking a scale of billions of dollars versus millions of dollars. And the problem is as a society, we have to really look more carefully at, are we investing enough and truly understanding what's going on? And the answer, I think, is definitively no. And so this is a larger issue than just OCCRP.
Yeah, and I guess that maybe that that jumps back to the point that we were talking about before about partners with a much more global reach or a much larger global reach, and partnering with the right organizations, like, say, I don't know, off the top of my head, The Guardian, because then at least you have a fighting chance, but also The Guardian comes with its own issues.
Yeah, I mean, we're tracking about 1 million a month on our site alone. So, and throughout the OCCRP network, you know, we're reaching somewhere around $15 million people a month. So
it's sizable.
I mean, we're equivalent to a fairly large, you know, news organization.
Yeah.
You know, just ourselves. And then once we, you know, go in The Guardian and other partner organizations, you know, we have tremendous reach. But so it's not reaching people really. It's really more a function of, there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Even at The Guardian, they have a handful of investigative reporters. You know, I've got 40 investigative editors, you know, working with about 260 investigative reporters. But there needs to be 10 more, 20 more OCCRPs in the world. You know, we're thinking of the wrong scale. We're on the wrong scale level. We need to boost this up massively.
Yeah.
Because the world is getting far more complex. It's getting far less transparent. And there's a lot more corruption. Even in America, you know, in cities, big cities, corruption is at all-time levels. And when there's no, you know, person watching out, when there's no natural enemy, these things just get out of hand. And that's what's happening.
I'm also wondering if you've ever heard of, or if this would be an initiative that would be adopted by, you know, various governments and educating bodies of the world. But when I was at school, at least, we never learned about corruption at the young in the younger years. Potentially, that would be a good pilot program to run as OCCRP, as a side to social studies or something like that. But in the earlier years of school, not in university, and you know, 18 and above.
Well, there are people who do that better than us, and we would hope that they would be interested. Sounds like a great idea. We'd be happy to help, you know, provide content for people to understand how this really works.
Because I guess what you're talking about is a pipeline of talented resources, i.e., you know, human resources who can jump into the job as an investigative journalist. And, you know, from what I understand, it's fairly slim pickings to get really good investigative journalists. And it's a particular mindset, particular mind.
Great investigative reporters are born, and, you know, they can be very successful in other industries and make a lot more money and sleep better at night. So it's difficult to attract them to the industry, and it's difficult to, you know, to find them. You know, it's a real challenge. So absolutely, you know, 10% of the people do 90% of the work in the world. And, you know, we constantly need, you know, those 10%. And, you know, because these stories are incredibly complex and incredibly difficult to uncover. So, you know, it's a constant, you know, fight. But the good news is that a lot of really good people find us on a regular basis. So, you know, we have a wonderful team, and I've, you know, I've never had a, you know, greater respect for a group of people than the people who work at OCCRP, and they work extremely hard. I mean, you know, 12-hour days are not unusual for many, many people on staff. So, you know, even in the administration section. So they're committed and they're dedicated to doing this. You know, there just needs to be, we just need a whole lot more of this.
Well, I think that's a good place to stop, because it sounds you're doing a magnificent job, you and the team. To people in my network, obviously, we'll be promoting this, and please feel free to reach out to Drew directly, and you'll be quite easy to find, or you can even give your email address. Actually, Drew, why don't you tell people where they can find you on Twitter or on email?
Sure. I mean, drew@occrp.org. You know, I'm there. OCCRP.org has a you can go there and you can put in a question or anything, and that does get to us. You know, I see those on a daily basis. You know, you can contribute to OCCRP on the donate page there. You can read and promote us on Twitter. I'm at Drew OCCRP. We're pretty easy to find on Twitter and Facebook.
And lastly, jobs. What jobs are you looking for beyond also just the investigative journalist positions? Are there other positions available in OCCRP currently?
Yeah, I mean, we actually hire people in, you know, in the investigative side from law enforcement or due diligence or, you know, business intelligence. We started doing that and have had some good success. Traditionally, it's gone the other way, where that industry has hired investigative reporters, you know, and so we've been kind of hiring people back from that industry. And finding, you know, people who are sick of working for, you know, large businesses or organized crime figures, you know, to do research for them. And so we've had good luck. We've been meaning to hire somebody from the banking industry, you know, but, you know, I don't have a lot of, you know, job positions, and, you know, they're fairly rare at OCCRP, but we do have some postings up and you know, on our jobs page. And, you know, we're always interested in, you know, people with, you know, particular skills who write to us, but it's tough to, you know, it's tough to always come up with the money to pay people, and we don't pay as well as we should, although we pay well for our industry. You know, it's something that's a work in progress.
Yeah, but I'm sure you don't have to worry about the banks. I'm sure they're clean. All right, mate. Well, look, on that note, thank you so much again. I really enjoyed this. And we'll look forward to catching up with you somewhere in the world soon.
Okay, great. Thanks.
No worries. Cheers. Bye.
Take care.